Hello and welcome. It's Tuesday and you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Don't forget, today there's a brand new episode of True Crime Tuesday available as well. And this one, this is different, folks. This is different than any of the True Crime Tuesdays we've covered in the past. It's historic. It is amazing. We do not have Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals because I felt that that was doing the episode a disservice. It is an amazing story, a very personal journey for this woman who went in search of the history of her family, only to uncover these atrocities, these murders, these horrific details of her family's past. And you have to hear the show. If you have not subscribed yet, please, this is the episode to start with. All you have to do is go to darknessradio.com, click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, subscribe right now. $5 a month gets you 4 brand new 90 to 120 minute episodes every week. And they are some of the most compelling true crime stories. Plus, usually you get the Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals at the end of the show where we lighten it up a little bit. So go check it out and please review. Let us know what you think of the show. Today, we are focused on another interesting aspect for Beyond the Darkness. This is something that's always intrigued me, and that somebody finally came out with a book. This is exciting to me. So I wanted to reach out to him. RJ von Bruning is a new author and an amateur astronomer with an extensive technical background in the electrical industry. He spent most of his life quietly researching the occult, secret societies, conspiracy theories, and the strange world of the paranormal, that which keeps the show going. In his groundbreaking first book, The Forbidden Knowledge of Enoch, is the product of this work and is going to make you ask the questions, is the story of humanity far older and richer than the institutions of society have led us to believe? Welcome to the show, RJ. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dave. Glad to be here.
Talk to me a little bit about your background before we get into the book. Did you always have a fascination with the supernatural and the strange, or was this something that came to you as you got older?
No, I've always been interested in it. As far back as I can remember, I've always been interested in science fiction and UFOs and the idea that there's life spread out through the universe. I'm a product of my generation growing up in the 70s and 80s. And as I got older, I just got more interested in conspiracy theories and the paranormal and just so many of the fascinating stories that people have told over the years, and always been curious if they're true.
Well, we're going to dig into that, and I want some of the background, too, if you've had any supernatural experiences, anything like that on your own. But you're a little far away sounding from the microphone for us. I don't know if we're just having a little bit of a connectivity issue, but I want to make sure that we can hear everything you're going to say. So I don't know if you need to pull a microphone up closer to you or what, but let's not miss anything. Have you ever had any supernatural experiences yourself?
Not too much in the way of seeing ghosts or anything like that. But over the years, especially when I was growing up in southeastern Arizona, I saw a number of strange lights and most likely experimental aircraft that I couldn't identify over the years. And then everybody down there, too, that I grew up with kind of all have the same stories of seeing strange objects and things that don't seem to follow the normal laws of physics, and that has always been fascinating to me. It's one of the reasons why I kind of got into astronomy, is because I was wondering, always, you know, curious, are we alone? Are there other planets out there? Could somebody be visiting us, or are we missing something? Because I can't believe that everybody's just making these stories up. And a lot of these people I knew personally, and they were good, honest people and had absolutely no reason to lie or to gain from it. In fact, if they went public with it, they were kind of ridiculed. So, you know, they tend to keep their mouths shut. And that just sparked my curiosity that I just, you know, it kind of gets in under your skin and you just want to know. And as you learn and do more research, it just keeps building. You want to know more and more and more. And it's been a lifelong fascination now.
Well, that aspect I understand, kind of following into this, and certainly your interest in astronomy, you're looking to the skies all the time, and there are very strange things going on in the skies above us, RJ, as we both know. What got your interest, though, in this forbidden knowledge of the Book of Enoch? What drew your attention to this?
One of the biggest things is I grew up in a Masonic family, but my part of the family didn't really want to have too much to do with it, and it wasn't ever really discussed much, but my grandparents and uncles and things like that were always involved, and I was always kind of told about it, but never any real details. And it always kind of just fascinated me about secret societies and these mystery schools and mystery religions, and always kind of wanting to know what their little secret is. And that kind of just has always been there in the background, kind of wanting to know more about it. But I've never been really interested in joining any of these organizations, and mainly because of the type of work I've been doing over the years. I work on government projects and things like that, doing electrical work, and the government's not real fond of memberships and secret societies and things like that.
Well, let's talk. You use a bunch of methods to do your research for this book. One of the tools you use, you call archaeoastronomy. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, archaeoastronomy is pretty straightforward. It's taking advantage of the phenomenon known as proper motion. And this is just basically that the stars that we see in the night sky are not fixed. They're all moving independent of our own solar system. And over periods, long periods of time, they change position from our line of sight. And we can measure that and we can calculate it, and it can be used as a timekeeping piece. This is usually done with probably the most famous monument of Stonehenge. Has been used as a calendar to measure the equinoxes and the growing seasons and things like that. So it's a pretty old tradition. And I think it's a discipline that's not really explored enough by mainstream science, especially now that our measurements and stuff are so precise and we can get good, accurate data.
I'm fascinated by this story because, you know, I grew up Lutheran, going to a Lutheran grade school, learning the Bible. And like many of the listeners out there, and don't worry, folks, this isn't an overtly religious show. This is talking about the mysteries and histories of some things that have been left out of our history that make no sense. And I grew up believing that the books of the Bible were the books of the Bible. That was it. There was no more. As I've gotten older, I've come to realize that King James had a hand in it, and other people along the line have culled certain books and changed things and paraphrased and kind of made it their own as time went by. And there are references to other books of the Bible within the Bible, Enoch being one of them, but yet it's not part of the canon. And to me, that was a very strange aspect of this. And What were the mysteries hidden inside these books that kept them from being included in the contextual version that we have today? And, you know, there are a lot of these things that have come out, that different books and stories from like the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of these Gnostic chapters and such. What drew your attention most to Enoch, though?
Mainly over the years as I studied the UFO phenomenon, and especially when the ancient astronaut theory became, much more popular, I noticed there was numerous references to Enoch, and I've always loved studying ancient history and books and stuff. And this one, like you just said, a lot of mystery surrounding it. And about 8-9 years ago, I finally managed to get my hands on a copy of one, and sat down and read it and was amazed by it. First thing that went through my mind was, why wasn't this book in the Bible? And that's when I started doing the research to find out more about Enoch and the book and why it was removed, because at one time it was part of the canon, or was accepted as the canon. And in 364 AD, in one of the infamous councils of the early church, it, along with basically what is the pseudo-apocryphal texts of today, were removed. And Enoch's a little bit different than the other books, is because we actually have the arguments that the church fathers made on why this book needed to be removed. And in the case of Enoch is it provided way too much information. It raised a lot of questions, and it didn't really have too much to do with the message of salvation that the church was trying to push at the time. And it also, in the way it was written, is it's written in the first person, and it shows a very personal one-on-one relationship between God and Enoch. And the church isn't too hip on that idea of not having them in the picture. So the book was removed.
Isn't that strange? I mean, first of all, if you're going to go to the problem of trying to remove this book from the Bible and what it stood for, why not erase the context in the Bible that refers to Enoch and the book of Enoch?
In a lot of ways, they kind of did. There's only a handful of references. There's three references to it in the New Testament and just the small little tidbit in the book of Genesis of talking of the patriarchs. As a whole, what makes Enoch so intriguing is that the stories were remembered by the people, even though the book was removed. And it ends up basically being the source material for most of the folklore that people have about the fallen angels and hearing about giants and of the gods or the angels mating with human women. And that was what people wanted to hear. And it actually, like I said, the church in the third century was actually interfering with the masses and stuff because people didn't want to hear about salvation. They wanted to hear about the fallen angels. They wanted to hear about Noah. They wanted to hear about Enoch talking to God. And it just interfered with what they were trying to do. And
doesn't that fly in the face of the idea behind religion and churches, is the fact that if we're supposed to share the word of God and these experiences and stories, because according to the experts right on this, the Bible is the word of God. These people are transcribing their stories because they were basically told to or led to do these type of things. How do we as man, how do we dictate what is important in God's literature or not? And again, I'm not trying to get heady and into religion on this, but that seems to contradict the whole essence of what the Bible was about. These real life encounters, these real life stories and possibilities.
I agree with that. But one of the big problems with it, and what's one of the secrets of understanding the book of Enoch, mm-hmm. is the symbolism. Most people are aware that in the biblical story, there is a lot of symbolism,
right?
Especially when you get deep into it. And that's where the book of Enoch comes in, because within these stories, there's actually two stories. There is a literal one for the common people, and then there is a hidden esoteric one for only the initiate. And this story is told through the symbolism. And once you know the symbolism, it kind of opens up the window. And once you kind of know some of the symbolism, you can start seeing that the church fathers and different sects of Christianity and King James and everything, that a lot of changes and stuff were made for political reasons or for personal interpretations at the time. And they've been kind of just left that way over the centuries. Actually been lucky over the last couple of centuries to be able to retrieve a number of these books and see what was actually removed. And like I said, the big problem is the symbolism is what screws everybody up, and that's what's kind of hidden. And that's what I stumbled upon within the book of Enoch, is it provides the key to understand this symbolism.
So this works kind of like the key of a map. By having the book of Enoch, you're able to unlock the mysteries of the other books of the Bible to understand what the stories and symbology means, is what you're saying.
basically, and that's where I concentrate on the section of the book that's known as the dream vision. It's also known as the prophecy of the animals. And it's an allegorical or symbolic retelling of the biblical story that uses animals to represent people and nationalities and men to represent angels. And what's so important about this story is because it is an outline of the biblical story, and it's basically been sitting on a shelf for 1600 years without being edited. Like you said earlier, that the Bible's been changed, books have been omitted, there's been editing. This is where the dream vision comes in. We have a 1600-year-old outline of the biblical story before the editing took place.
All right, well, start us off at the beginning here. Who was Enoch?
Enoch is kind of an enigma. What little is known about him is pretty much comes from the book of Genesis in chapter 5 of being a patriarch. He's basically most famously known as the great-grandfather of Noah. What little is in the Bible states that he walked with God, he lived 365 years, and then he was not, for God took him. And the tradition has always been that Enoch never died, that he was actually transmuted into a higher state and went and lived with God. The book of Enoch actually helps provide all the other information about him. And in it, we're told that he's a scribe, and he's a unique scribe because he tells a story of where the angels were told to teach Enoch how to write so he would become a righteous scribe. And that's kind of where it's unique in that aspect of where most other people are commanded or compelled or anything, but he specifically tells that he's taught to write by the angels themselves in order to pass these words on. And the other unique aspect is that it's all written in the first person. Outside of that, Enoch is really kind of a mystery. Everything else we know about him basically comes from legends and folklore that have grown up over the millennium since the book was originally written. Things of where he is thought to be very intelligent, or that he had secret knowledge or secret information. And a lot of this seems to come out of the Middle Ages and the Protestant Reformation, when people were curious about this book because it had been removed and everybody wondered why it was removed. What did it contain? What was so secret that the church removed it and banned it?
All right. You've got this information about this book that was removed. You're able to actually find the original texts from this book. And you start talking about the fables and other legends that start to pop up around about Enoch. Can you tell me about some of those? What were the earliest iterations you were able to uncover?
Enoch is always kind of floating around in the background, mainly because of the stories related to the fall of the angels and the idea of the corruption of man, which is embedded within the Judeo-Christian tradition. What makes it kind of so interesting is that this story, through the symbolism, starts unlocking the other cultures and stuff. And where it gets so fascinating is that it starts with basically the Adam and Eve story, except he uses bulls or oxen to describe these individuals. And this is where it starts being important, is because this symbolism of the bulls allows you to understand that it represents the first men, and that when it's applied to other cultures and other mythologies, you start understanding that these stories that talk about bulls are actually talking about the first men. So you can start, it is kind of difficult to explain without the whole story for how the symbolism slowly starts unlocking the rest of the story.
Well, walk us through that aspect then. How do these symbols, and how were you able to look at what he wrote about and uncover what the symbology meant and how it connected to the rest of the legend of the Bible and the stories that are being told and shared?
Well, the key part is, like I said right there, was the bulls representing the first men. The way he describes it is that he sees a great white bull come forth from the earth, and then he sees a heifer and then a red and a black bull come forth from the earth, which right there is a little different, because in the book of Enoch, he portrays Cain and Abel not as the sons of Adam and Eve, but actually being brought forth the same time Eve is, which changes the story. And that's kind of where you start seeing these little aspects. And the biggest key is understanding that these bulls, these oxen, represent the first men. So realizing that this symbolism represents the first men, if we go to Greek mythology, which is full of stories of Zeus coming down and transforming himself into a bull to seduce some young maiden, most of the time it's conceived of, when you hear that, that he transforms into a bull, the actual animal, and that's why we kind of think of it as mythology. Within Enoch, you would understand that that bull actually represents the first man or first men. So when Zeus comes down and transforms himself into a bull, he's transforming himself into a first man. And the story makes a little bit more sense. It's still kind of fantastical and mythological, but it comes a little closer into the realm of possibility. And then also going through the Bible, using the symbolism of the bull, and also for that, the dream vision is a symbolic retelling using animals, you can unlock things of understanding that the story of Noah and the ark, that he's not actually, the biblical story is not actually talking about physical animals. When Noah's told to take animals on board, most people think he took two elephants and two gorillas and two penguins and things like that. With understanding the dream vision, you understand that the animals represent people, and he's not actually taking people onto this boat, or not actually taking animals onto the boat, but taking people onto the boat. And that's where the story starts changing, where it's basically the same, but there's additional information that's told through the symbolism. And this just keeps consistently going through and building upon itself. The other great aspect about it is that there's enough information within the dream vision to see what parts of the Bible have actually been, parts of the story have been removed or changed, predominantly removed.
All right. Well, start to enlighten us about that. I mean, as you now unlock the keys that Enoch seems to hold, what starts to change in the Bible? I mean, what you just told us about the Genesis story and Noah, that makes a lot of sense. Because, again, there's claims of the story of Noah and the massive flood through many different religions and belief systems around the world. So the denial of the fact that there was maybe a great flood at some point doesn't seem to be really, I guess, a bone of contention. It's believed that that did occur at some point because so many different cultures around the world relay the same story. The idea that you could build a boat big enough to carry two of every animal and repopulate the earth with it seems ridiculous.
Yeah, and it does. And that's one of the things that's always been a contentious part of the debate. And it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, you really, to believe that every animal was put onto a small boat as described, but realizing that it's people, and that when you see animal symbolism in the Bible, that the vast majority of time it is actually referring to different nationalities or different groups of people. And that's where the dream vision, again, comes into play, because it helps unlock this symbolism. So you can start understanding that it's not talking about cattle, it's talking about the first men. It's not talking about animals running around in the field, it's talking about different nationalities. And at first, this kind of sounds a little strange to people, but it's a symbolism we still use today. I mean, we think of America, you think of the bald eagle. You think of Russia, you think of the bear. So the idea of using animal symbolism to represent people or nationalities is not, you know, it's a very commonly used thing, so common that we don't even notice it.
Right. Even the Native Americans are big on that, the different totems and the animals that represent different bands and families within the Native American culture. So that's a fascinating aspect to me, definitely. Why do you think it is then? Just out of curiosity, and I understand you do not have the definitive answer on any of this, but I'm curious as we're picking your brain, as somebody who spent so much time researching this, why write these books in ways that everything is subverted and hidden? If you really are trying to share the story of mankind and history, why not just relate it in the clearest, easiest to define and understand, so that we're not left with all these questions, which then you unlock something like this and it begins people questioning everything that they thought they knew about religion, which seems like it's undermining its own system. So you would assume that they would just write these books of, hey, this is what happened. This is how it happened. Here's a parable to learn a lesson that was taught to me by my teacher or rabbi or leader, instead of these kind of whimsical tales that make no sense in the real world, and then removing the key code to explain it all seems even more ludicrous.
Well, one of the reasons this happened is you kind of have to go back to history and understand the beginnings of early writing. And it's kind of hard for us to imagine today, when writing and reading is so common, that in the earliest civilizations, it gave a small group of people an incredible amount of power. And through this, mainly for political reasons, you end up with two stories being developed. One that's for the common people who can't read, and then there is the secret or initiated story for the people who do. So it's more of a kind of a security system to help protect the writing, is how it was developed, because we all know how easy it is to learn how to read and write. So anybody could learn how to do it. So this way they could make it very difficult, and at the same time they were able to control it. And it's basically a security system is what it comes out of. In my new book, which hopefully will be out here in about 9 months, I go into a little bit more detail and the history of how and why the scribes and the early governments and stuff did this, and it ends up being a very effective way to encode information. And that's where everybody kind of forgets that language and the early writings and stuff were not for the common people. It was being used by militaries, it was being used by governments and very powerful people, and that's how they maintain their control. So, and in order to keep that control, you told the people one thing and you kept the real information for yourself.
How bizarre. And you know, I know that people would write in codes. I mean, Nostradamus did it because, again, you didn't want to be found treasonous or slanderous or blasphemous. So you would write in a way that could be kind of interpreted many different ways, while subverting the real lesson of the story, I think, is what a lot of them had to do in order to stay alive.
Yes, and that's pretty much the historical reason. And like I said before, the biggest thing is people forget on how that up until modern printing went in the late 1400s, that the average person couldn't read.
Well, let's look a little bit, as we're kind of examining the ideas of the Bible, why would Christian churches and institutions around the world use Armageddon and you know, the threat of the second coming of Christ to scare people into believing that their interpretation and how the world ends and what's going on in the world and the world events, what's to gain by running under a term of fear, I guess?
biggest thing is fear for control. It's one of the oldest ones in the book. It's very effective, and we can look back in history that up until the scientific revolution, it was very effective of keeping people in line, of following the rules and not questioning things. And that's kind of been destroyed over the last few centuries, thanks to science and research. But it still boils down to nothing but good old fashioned control and power.
So you believe, again, it's just kind of, hey, this could happen. We're your leaders. Don't worry. We're here to walk you through this. So it was the way to kind of control the herd mentality.
Pretty much. And that's pretty standard throughout history.
I mean, even in our own day. I was going to say our news is filled with scare tactics constantly.
Right. And, you know, and that's been used through the centuries very effectively.
Now, what are mystery schools and religions? What do they teach?
The mystery schools and religions basically teach the dream vision and unlock the symbolism. As most people are most familiar with is the Masons, since they're one of the oldest and best known on the planet. We're all familiar with all the symbolism, the all-seeing eye, the triangle, the ever-famous partial pyramid on the back of the dollar bill. And they basically follow this same tradition of using the symbolism to hide and tell and continue on these stories. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, because it is a very old tradition. And it's been a way to keep passing on information. Back in the Middle Ages, they were basically known as wizards and alchemies and for hermetic thought and those types of schools. And that's where they were kind of born out of, is this idea that there is secret knowledge. There's more information out there on how the world works, on what's going on. And this eventually leads into eventually a science revolution and our modern world.
Now, you keep referring to the dream vision. And, you know, just for maybe a better understanding for myself and for the listeners, what exactly does that mean? There's different context. You know, I've heard of dream visions, but what are you referring to when you continually reference that?
When I continually reference the dream vision, that within the Book of Enoch, there are two visions, which are known as the dream visions, with the second one being also known as the prophecy of the animals. This story is, like I said before, the key to understanding the symbolism that unlocks it all. So when I refer to the dream vision, I'm talking about the dream vision contained in the Book of Enoch.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We've got more with RJ and more to research and investigate. Fascinating topic. The idea that we can dig back into history and still 2017 years later uncover new possibilities and truths about documents that are centuries and millennia old. This is fascinating. Stay with us. We've got more as we continue to examine the secret histories and mysteries surrounding Enoch. We'll do that next, right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Later on this week, we are going to be joined by the legendary researcher, author, and the godfather of the near-death experience. We're going to be talking with Dr. Raymond Moody, and we're going to talk about oracles of death, communicating with the other side, using things like the psychomantium and other methods. He also has an experiment he's going to talk to me a little bit about that I may participate in this year. So tune in and you'll hear about that as well. That's going to take place on Friday, plus a really creepy theater of the mind my own experience using the Psychomantium at the Palmer House Hotel. So it's a good chiller. You'll get 2 weeks back-to-back of my own Theater of the Mind stories. You guys are always asking me to hear my stories, so Tim's got the task of putting them together and creeping you out with my original histories. That's what's going on tonight, though. The Forbidden Knowledge of Enoch. R.J. von Bruning is our guest today, and we're talking about the research. And the book is not out currently. It's supposed to come out a little later on this year, correct?
Yes. It was available for a few years, but my publisher, unfortunately, went bankrupt. And so I'm taking this opportunity to rewrite it, and it should be available in about 6 to 9 months is the current plan.
Have you been able to dig up in the time since it originally came out to today? Have you been able to dig up quite a bit more information and knowledge from your research?
Oh, yes, I have. I plan for the new book for anybody out, for any of your listeners who happen to read Forbidden Knowledge of Enoch. The new book will include all that information plus additional information that's been found and things that weren't included in the first one that will be included in the second one.
Well, talk to me a little bit about that. If you don't mind, give us some insights. I mean, it's been a while. What are some of the things that you've been able to uncover, you know, in the time since the publication of the first book?
One of the most fascinating things that I've been able to discover and ran across was that within the dream vision in the Book of Enoch, there is a part where it speaks of lambs being sent to humanity to help turn us from our wayward ways, and have discovered that within the mystery schools and religions, there is actually a lot of information related to these lambs. And one of the most fascinating things is that they claim that Jesus is only one of 16 savior gods that all basically had the exact same life spread out over about a 1,200-year period. And these individuals ended up going to different peoples. And that's been one of the most fascinating things, to discover that the Catholic Church really went out of its way to destroy the other stories of these other individuals that were very similar or almost exactly like Jesus Christ. A couple of them people have heard of before, like Krishna and Mithras from Roman lore, but the vast majority of them have basically been wiped from history.
Isn't the story of Osiris this basically the exact same story as Jesus Christ as well?
Yes, and that's where it was fascinating, because there's always this debate, you can see it online and stuff, of people saying that all these stories are talking about the same person. No, historically it does appear that there were separate individuals that all basically had the exact same life and the exact same message. And that's where it gets fascinating, because you start raising questions of going, well, how could all these people have the exact same life, same stories, right, and things? And it really appears that there is some outside force, whether it be alien or divine or something else, influencing these events.
So the reality is Jesus is more like a Time Lord from Doctor Who. He just keeps re-evolving into new versions of that story as time progresses, or there are different iterations of him. That's kind of a fascinating aspect, that there may be 12 to 16 of these beings that have come and gone through our history. But that also, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, part of the Book of Revelations talks about the fact that Revelation, that they're going to try to unify and have just one church, just one belief system.
And correct.
Isn't that what Christianity basically was trying to do by eradicating the belief in all of the others?
Basically.
So were they trying to be the catalyst to begin the end times by doing that?
It's very possible. It's hard to say what the motivations exactly were, because one of the things within this story, and the most radical part, is that it basically tells you that the Armageddon, the final battles, the end of times has already happened. Not only has it already happened, but it happened thousands and thousands of years ago. And that's how we have these stories. That's one of the other aspects about going into all the symbolism and also kind of why you understand why some of the books have been removed is to give this illusion that this isn't history, but prophecy.
Interesting. Wow, that's a fascinating aspect of this story I hadn't considered before.
Yeah, and that's where this gets so kind of crazy, is that it basically tells you that these events that we're all familiar with happened, but they happened thousands of years earlier than we're taught that they are. And that the end of times has already happened.
Do you get a lot of grief from the religious sect because of this book and this research?
Actually, no. When they read it, they don't want to talk to me. They really don't.
It's a paradigm shifter. And again, folks, this is not an attack on Christianity or belief. This is simply an investigation and an examination of what we've believed was true and what is true, what is not, what are the definitions of these stories. That's why I thought this would be a fascinating topic for the show. And this starts going into some weird places. Since we're talking Armageddon and we're talking about weird stuff, let's talk about wormwood, right? You got scientists and researchers that claim wormwood is a comet, an asteroid, whatever, and the Bible states that wormwood is a star. So what exactly is wormwood in your opinion?
This is where it gets really interesting, right? And it's kind of hard to jump right into the middle because there's a huge backstory leading up. But very simply put is that the gods of our ancestors, where did they live? Most people, if you look at the mythologies, we're told that Zeus lived in Olympia. We have the references in the Judeo-Christian of heaven. And the Vikings talk of it as Asgard. And in all these ancient stories, they talk of this place, this abode of the host of heaven, as Enoch calls it, as a great city. Even within Christianity, we all think of heaven up above the pearly gates, above the clouds, and things like that. When you go through this story, you start realizing that it appears that there was a great ship in low Earth orbit. This is the home of the gods. And this is actually the symbolism of the all-seeing eye. That's what it represents, is this eye. And it looked like an eye to our ancestors from the ground. That's why they remember it that way. And we, to this day, still remember it as Mandela's and the all-seeing eye. And what it was basically a city in space. And most people go, oh, well, that's just the ancient astronaut theory. It sounds like science fiction. But it's actually a very old tradition that the gods live up above the clouds. The idea that there's some type of city where you have to go up there, you have to go through gates. And this is basically what Wormwood is this great ship plunging toward the Earth and its final destruction. What is so incredible about this is once you know some of the details, you can actually plot out a trajectory and end up with a crater that seems to match a giant ship coming into the atmosphere and exploding.
That's freaky.
Not only is it freaky,
that sounds very Battleship Earth too, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds, some of these other fringe religions out there might be onto something.
And that's where this gets really wild, is you start realizing that big chunks of the ancient astronaut theory have been taken from this. And this is where they're getting these ideas, but they're still leaving out small little details that have been missing because they haven't had the dream vision to help unlock the symbolism.
Oh, my gosh. Just absolutely bizarre. Now, you said there was this huge backstory, and we kind of jumped into the middle with this. Can you give us kind of a summary of this backstory that you were referring to?
Okay, one of the big things that is missing within the biblical text, mm-hmm. Everybody's mostly familiar that the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles basically ends with the first temple being destroyed. And then we get the prophets and then eventually the New Testament. The dream vision shows that that is actually the beginning of a war. And this war goes on for a very long period of time and eventually ends with the Book of Revelations. The Book of Revelations is actually the ending of this war. And that's one of the big pieces that is missing in the backstory, is this: there is a massive war in the background that the gods start. And they start slaughtering people, they start destroying things, and they start battling among themselves. And this war eventually ends up with the destruction of the ship and the destruction of everything they had built here. And that's where the little secret, the dirty little secret is within these mystery schools and this belief, is that thousands of years ago, there was a society, a civilization on this planet that was two-tiered. One part was highly advanced, probably more advanced than we are today, and one part that was really primitive and was exploited, which was our ancestry.
Now, is there any kind of real historic proof of that, though, aside from theory and conjecture?
Well, that's where I think I'm a little bit different, is I provide you a crater that appears to date from about the right time of, we know that approximately 10,800 BC, that some cataclysmic event happened on this planet and led to the extinction of a great number of animals and basically started the Ice Age again. And I theorize that it's the impact of this ship that causes this. And there is a crater that dates from about the right time in Alaska that is very unusual. It has an incredibly high metal content. The explosion was so powerful it actually cracked the bedrock, and it's been estimated that it was somewhere around 26,000 megatons of force when this thing went off. And what's so amazing about this crater is that whatever blew up seemed to have blown up in the air and never actually hit the ground. But then you have all this metal. In fact, there's so much metal that scientists have estimated that it would take a solid chunk of nickel iron about 600 meters across to equal the amount of force and metal found at this crater.
Huh. That's astounding. And this is in Alaska. Are there satellite pictures that we can see of this impact zone?
Actually, you can. It's just south of Anchorage, but you can't really see the crater too much. But the whole valley, it's about 60 miles south of Anchorage, the whole valley looks devastated in it. It's clearly, in fact, that's how the crater was discovered, was through satellite imagery back in 1972 using the Landsat satellite.
That's crazy. And you know what's really weird to me, on kind of a side note, is how much UFO activity is seen over that area and that location as well.
Yeah, and this is where it gets even crazier. I love how you keep saying that. Yeah,
things are already crazy here, RJ. I don't know if you're keeping up with this story, but we're already deep, deep, deep into crazy land. This is just getting weirder. Okay, go ahead. What have you got?
If you go back to Wormwood and take that step by step and realize that the ship coming in, you realize that this thing, we're told that it, at one point, it breaks into two pieces with one piece hitting the ocean. And I theorize that this trajectory is coming across basically from the southeast to the northwest. So coming in across the eastern United States, kind of at a diagonal toward Alaska. And that this ship blowing in two pieces occurs over the mid-Atlantic, and one of the pieces ends up hitting off the east coast of the United States, where the crazy, strange things of the Bermuda Triangle go on. And then the debris from this separation of the ship into two pieces ends up hitting the east coast, creating what's known as the Carolina Bays, which are over 100,000 impact sites up and down the coast that have no explanation. And then the second piece of the ship goes flying across the continental United States, and that's what ends up blowing up in Alaska. And that we actually have a huge debris field. And if you follow this, you have UFO activity all the way from Alaska all the way into the Bermuda Triangle area, as if they're keeping an eye on this stuff or trying to retrieve the debris.
Wow. All right, talk to me a little bit about, we're talking about this alien civilizations, ancient astronaut theories. Why this theory is being presented to the public as kind of a replacement for God and the devil? Kind of walk me through that understanding.
There's a lot of debate out there. What I suspect and what I've proposed in the book, and I'll propose again in my new book, is that these gods, these aliens, as people like to refer to them, they never left, and they couldn't leave because they blew everything up. And there's a good chance that, and there's been a lot of rumor, that some type of disclosure is going to happen. I think this is being presented to get people ready for the inevitable fact that sooner or later these beings are going to make contact with us officially. And it's just being presented that way. And that's too where it gets interesting, because once you start learning this story and getting into all the little details, is you start realizing that they would have to hide, because I think you would recognize these beings if you spent any time with them.
Well, how is it that we relate them to God and the devil, though? I mean, what is the breakdown of that theory?
The big thing basically has to go all the way back to the fall of the angels and that part of the story. And that kind of leans on what's been presented in the ancient astronaut theory, that mankind was originally created as slaves. And the fall of the angels is basically one of these beings that was our slave master rising up and freeing humanity. He is now remembered today as Satan and the devil. But in the very beginning, and that's something else that's presented in the Book of Enoch, in this fall, that you realize that it was a good thing. The people loved it. It wasn't considered evil. People were learned how to write. They were brought in technology. They were brought in freedom. They were given civilization. And this paints the God of the Bible in a really bad light. And that's kind of where the duality starts going on. And you start realizing that there is some type of political conflict going on between these two groups. And one is remembered as the God of the Bible, and the other one is remembered as the bad guy, Satan. But at one time in the story, their roles were basically reversed.
That is crazy. And we've talked about that kind of weird aspect too, that, right, that the devil is referred to as the morning star and this beautiful power. And why would things that it appears so beautiful, why would it be the evil one? And I know that sounds very vain and materialistic, but it just seems funny, right, that he's talked about in this sense of reverence.
Because in the very beginning, like I said, in the very beginning of the story, he was the good guy. He was the liberator. He was the one that brought knowledge to mankind. He was the God that came and lived among mankind. The problem is as if you know your biblical history, you realize that eventually leads to the flood, the giants, the Nephilim, other creepy little creatures, and that great violence and sin and war engulfs the world, which eventually the other side has to intervene. And that's kind of where the story starts changing, from where the light bearer, the morning star, goes from being the good guy to kind of becoming the bad guy, where the conditions started out really good, and then, like most civilizations, decayed, fell apart, and destroyed itself.
You know, that's an interesting aspect as well, because I talk about the fact that right now we are closer as a people and the human race than we've ever been. I can communicate with you as we're doing right now through a computer from two different states. I can tweet out my thoughts and have it instantaneously delivered to 50,000 followers. I can talk on the show and 250 to 300,000 people hear this message. We've become closer as a world, but the technology is also the knowledge, the information that we have has started to break us apart as a civilization, because there's this weird separation that even though we've never been closer, it seems like our humanity is starting to break apart because we're relying on technology for our communication and for our relationships at this point in history more than we've ever been before. So it's almost like the story in the Bible. The knowledge bringer brings the knowledge, enlightens, and sometimes that enlightenment causes distraction and causes bad things to happen.
Yeah, and that's true. And I think it's even reflected when, if this is true, if all these stories are true and the light bearer comes down and this is actually a technologically advanced society, we know in our own history that when a more technologically advanced society comes into contact with a not so advanced society, it's not very good. The technology and seems to consume the more primitive society. They can't handle it. It destroys them.
Right. Well, let's talk about the Book of Enoch and the Watchers. Who were or who are the Watchers? What's their involvement with humanity?
The Watchers are the angels, very simply put, of tradition, of the biblical tradition. In the case of the Book of Enoch, he refers to them as the Watchers because before the fall, their duties were to keep an eye on humanity, to kind of guide us, but above all else, just to sit and watch us, hence their name, the Watchers. When the Book of Enoch was removed, everybody kind of remembered that name, the Watchers, you know, kind of has a dramatic feel to it, and kind of a mythology kind of built up around them, but very simply, they're just the angels that eventually fall from heaven and corrupt mankind.
I know in the notes, pre-notes you gave me for the show, you mentioned something about Genesis 6-2. Normally not discussed in mainstream religions. Talk to us a little bit about that. Why specifically are you pointing that aspect out?
That's a big aspect of the Book of Enoch, because the dream vision and the Book of Enoch itself really fills in that gap in Genesis 6 of is because it gives the details of the fall of the angels, the corruption of mankind, the giants, the Nephilim, the war, the violence, the sin. And it's one of those things that the church fathers have always kind of overlooked. And it's also kind of an example where you can see where the Book of Enoch and the stories were removed and the little tidbit in the Bible was changed to this more vague little verse that people debate about. In fact, most of the Book of Enoch is Genesis 6, filling that huge gap in the story.
All right. And for our listeners trying to make sense of this as well, are there different versions of the Bible that are going to have a more complete aspect of this story or different views? What can you tell us about that? Or has Christianity pretty much cleaned it up even through the Jewish faith? I know they've got their standard version of the Bible. We've got ours. What kind of breakdowns and differences are you seeing in these different texts?
They're pretty consistent across the board. The big secret is understanding the hidden story through the symbolism or the esoteric part of the story. It's just how it's hidden. You have the literal story, and then you have the symbolic story. So all the different traditions use this, whether it's using the Christian Bible or using the Jewish Torah. The biggest thing I have noticed is that if you're in using the English language, you need to use the King James Version or the Greek Orthodox versions, because all the other versions of the Bible have been copyrighted. And that means they've been changed and edited and turned into a different book.
I never knew that. The Bible, or at least most of the recent iterations, are copyrighted?
Yes, if you go and grab a Bible, unless it's the King James Version or the Greek Orthodox Version, there will be a copyright within the cover.
Fascinating. If there's any question you have in your mind regarding the manipulation of man in this book, that should be the biggest answer right there for you.
Right, because you can go get a copy of the King James Version and just go to a store and buy a modern version and compare them together, and you can see the changes right there.
You know, there are these different races of angels that are referred to as well, things like the Nephilim and the cherubim and things like this that seem to fit almost alien-like senses in nature. Is that what you pick up through this connection as well, that these are, you know, what the Nephilim are, the children of the fallen angels and humanity? Is that the basic history that we've been led to believe so far, correct?
Basically, there's a lot of confusion around the Nephilim and the giants within the Book of Enoch and the dream vision. You're actually kind of fills in some of the gap and helps clean up Genesis 6, that the Nephilim are usually interpreted as meaning the giants. But you understand in the Book of Enoch that the Nephilim are the first generation. These are the half man, half. They are like their fathers.
You cut out. You said they were like half, and then you cut out. They were half what?
Half man and half god.
Okay.
Much like Perseus or in the Greek mythology, and they're thought to be just like their fathers were, that they were tall and beautiful and intelligent and powerful. And then when they take human wives, that then their children are the giants. And then there is also another third generation that is just vaguely referenced within the Book of Enoch, but I think it's referring to within like Greek mythologies and other mythologies. You have these strange little evil creatures like the Furies that have no description, but they are just considered to be evil, wicked little monsters that you never wanted to have anything to do with. And usually these were explained away as some type of punishment by the gods, that you angered the gods, so they gave you this monster to birth.
That would explain a lot with my children. I have angered the gods repeatedly, RJ. That's what the issue seems to be here. All right. You know, we bandied about, and there's shows about ancient alien theories, and you've mentioned the ancient alien theory. Can you explain for our listeners from your viewpoint, what is the true ancient alien theory? And this kind of war to save humanity from oppression, are we really meant to be a slave race, and there are these good and bad forces at work to take us over?
Based on the ancient stories and this interpretation, there are. We are vitally important somehow. Originally, it appears that we were just nothing more than a beast of burden, slave labor. But since that time, we've probably become something more. And when you start bringing in the modern day stories of UFOs and abductions and these claims of what appears to be some type of genetic manipulation or engineering going on, and I've talked with a number of people over the years too, that we kind of suspect that these beings are eventually going to make contact with us, but that we're not quite there yet, that we're still a little too primitive to be able to. And I've gotten into some interesting discussions with some highly educated people proposing that one of the problems is that they may be so advanced that right now that we can't communicate with them.
You would think, though, if they're that advanced, they could communicate with us. They would know how to backplay the system to communicate.
Well, and that's been brought up before, but, you know, it, without knowing exactly where they're at and their level of development, we kind of have to just speculate. It could be as simple as like us trying to communicate with a dolphin or something, that the natural barriers that the way they think, the way they do communicate, I mean, they may not even use a language. I mean, they may be totally telepathic, or maybe they have express emotions through smell. You know, there's thousands of different possibilities.
We are the dolphins. We are the dolphins to the alien race. All they have to do is push their clicker and throw us a couple of donuts, and we'll do all kinds of tricks for them.
Yeah, and there's been a number of sci-fi stories over the years that have kind of explored this of if we do run across somebody that's, you know, thousands or millions of years ahead of us, would we recognize it? Would we be able to communicate it? Would we be too stupid to be able to even talk to them yet?
Yes.
Or would
we can't even talk to one another on this planet. Have you been watching the news?
Right. We have our own problems with communication, so trying to bring in another species. Plus, there's other things that, you know, we can't even imagine that may be factors. You know, I mean, we all love Star Trek and stuff, that maybe they do have something that where they don't openly interfere until we reach a certain level.
The Prime Directive, right?
Yeah, something like that. But, it does make sense. I mean, we do the same thing when we study animals and things like that. We could be at a very dangerous point in our – I mean, we fight among ourselves, like you were just saying. We don't get along with each other. And that may be fascinating to them. You know, that may be a curiosity to them. So a lot of things can't be ruled out until we do eventually have this contact. But it does appear that over the last decade or so, there's more information coming out. Things are pointing in this direction. Documentation, governments have all been hinting in this direction. And I think there's a good chance.
Well, when you say that, I know my audience will get all over me of why not press them on that. What do you mean by they've been hinting at it, or they've been gearing up to it? What proof do we have that they are doing that, that there is some kind of preparation being made, I guess?
Well, just a good example would be just over the last 5 or 6 years that over 38 nations, including our own, have released hundreds of thousands of documents on the UFO phenomenon. In fact, Britain just released theirs just a month or two ago. And these documents,
but a lot of them are useless. There's redacted statements, and they, it's like, oh yeah, we'll release it because there's nothing to be seen or found. Nobody's found the smoking gun in all of these documents yet. They found that, yes, at times the government has said, we just don't know, but there's no smoking gun that says, yes, that we are in contact with alien races and planets, and this has happened.
I agree with you that there is no smoking gun, but I do think the documentation proves that the phenomenon is real, and that this, to me, is very strange, because back in the 80s and 90s, it was debunking. It didn't exist. You're crazy. You're nuts. We don't investigate this stuff. Project Blue Book.
Does it prove that it's real, or does it prove that people are fallible and make mistakes and always have?
That can be a factor, but I think that the sheer amount of documentation, I mean, the CIA was 110,000, and I've looked at some of them, and there are some good sightings from reputable witnesses that something strange is going on.
And I'm playing the devil's advocate when I'm talking about this, but you also realize that there was a point in our history when I could point my finger and say, R.J. von Brüning is a witch. He is changing the words of God. He is trying to manipulate us and entrance us. And next thing you'd know, RJ, you were being dipped in oil or
burned
at the stake. Right. So
exactly.
The fact is that we've thought of enlightenment before. We thought we were right about the way things went when we just couldn't explain it. The crops failed. Therefore, it was RJ Bruning's fault, von Bruning's fault, because he's a witch. Are aliens just the new witch? You know, I mean, are we, because there are so many people making claims and thinking they're seeing things, does that make it real?
Yes and no. I think in the case of have the aliens become the new devil, the new witch, everything being blamed on them. I think that's partially true. And there is a lot of just kind of garbage floating around out there that just makes you
leave. I mean it more on the scale of not necessarily that they are the new witch or this. It's just the fact that drawing the comparison of there are so many eyewitnesses that make it to be, you know, there can't be that many people wrong. But there were thousands of people wrong before talking about witchcraft. That's kind of what I was getting at, is the fact that, you know, you have enough people that start to believe it, and then other people buy into that theory, and they start expounding upon it and making it their own, and suddenly it's a thing. And I wonder, and trust me, I'm one that believes. I've seen things in the sky that cannot be explained away with science that I'm aware of. So I believe that we are being visited, and that we probably have always been visited, or that they're here among us right now as we speak and probably listening to the show. Just shoot me an email, dave@darknessradio.com. If you're from another planet, I want to know about you. But, you know, I believe all that exists. I'm just curious though, you know, we are a fallible race and we want to believe in anything. You know, look, Moses, I'm leading you through the wilderness. We've got this 40-year journey to get to the promised land. Things are going to be great. I'm going to go up this hill and talk to God. Well, Moses has been gone for a couple hours. We should really build a golden calf and start praying to it. People just want to believe in something all the time.
Yes, and that's true. They do. And I think you are correct that it's a big factor, and it's a problem with studying this. And one of the contributing factors is because of the misunderstanding of the symbolism, mm-hmm. and that you have a story hidden within the story.
Right.
And that the people in charge, a good example would be the Catholic Church. It's within their interest to help keep this confusion going for their own control and their own agendas. And I guess we could debate forever about it, but I kind of think more along the lines that these beings may not be actually aliens like we normally think, mm-hmm. that they've always kind of been here.
Right.
That this is home for them.
Right. We're the alien maybe race, right?
We could be, or they're part of an older species. One of the things that's kind of for a new idea of new information to be included in the book is that I noticed what used to be known as the Nemesis theory, the idea that the sun had an unseen companion in a 28 million year orbit that caused extinction events on this planet every 28 million years. That theory has kind of fallen to the wayside, but nothing has replaced this basically knowledge that every 28 million years there's an extinction event on this planet. And I've been kind of wondering, and I'll be putting it in the new book, is have we been looking at this idea the wrong way, and that these extinction events are caused by civilizations? Like our own civilization right now is causing extinctions. And how is this will be viewed in millions of years from now from a different species? And within that 28 million year time period too, there's more than enough time to wipe everything clean. You wouldn't even know anybody existed. And that's where these guys may have come from, that we may just be one of a long line of intelligences that have evolved on this planet.
Let's talk, being an astronomer yourself and interested in the stars, I've read many different books and researchers that point to the importance and significance of the Pleiades star system. What do you believe this is, and what is its connection to all of this? I mean, I've heard, you know, like that's the key. That is where we are from.
I disagree. Within the dream vision and doing the studying, I ran across the ancient cylinder seals of the Middle East that many people are familiar with. They're little, look like beads that can be rolled out onto wet clay or sand with little symbols and images on them. And upon these artifacts, they have the Pleiades cluster, most typically remembered as the seven sisters or seven stars, which is kind of interesting because today you can only see six with the naked eye. So kind of shows you an older time or from a longer time ago. One of the things I noticed being an amateur astronomer is as I started looking at these cylinder seals and started looking at the Pleiades cluster, and I started noticing movement when you get enough of these things together, and realizing that this had to do with proper motion, that these stars were moving, and that the Pleiades cluster may have been being used as a clock. And that is kind of where some of this kind of first clicked. In
you mentioned proper motion. What's
that? The stars are
behind that
is moving independent of us,
okay.
And within a small star cluster like the Pleiades cluster, this effect is amplified because these stars are interacting with each other, orbiting around each other. So over time, what we see changes rather quickly. Astronomically speaking, over thousands of years instead of millions or tens of thousands of years. And within the Pleiades clusters on the ancient cylinder seals, I had noticed that there was different configurations. And one of them had 10 stars, another one had 8, and then there was a series that I ran across that had the typical 7 sisters, but they were always in different configurations. And that's when it dawned on me that these ancient artifacts recording the Pleiades cluster, they're using it as a clock. That's what it looked like in the night sky at that time when that artifact was made. This is kind of one of those things you can't really fake. You really have to have really precise coordinates and information and no calculus unless you're sitting there actually observing it. So it's next to impossible to kind of fake this stuff.
So that is, in essence, a certificate of authenticity because it's able to be matched to that exact point in time, space, and history.
Right, and this is where it gets really fascinating is when you start doing the calculations.
You sound like you're at the end of a tunnel all of a sudden. I don't know if you've moved or something changed, but you sound
is that better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay. Must have a short in my cord here. That when you go back and do the calculations to find out how long ago it would have been when the stars looked in this configuration, I keep getting dates between 10,000 to 18,000 BC.
And that's what's telling you kind of when these ideals were being put down, when they were sharing this information.
Yeah, when these events were happening. Okay. And that's kind of one of the big secrets within the mystery schools and within this information. Like I said before, the events happened, they just happened thousands of years earlier than what we've been traditionally taught.
Gotcha. So what we're led to believe is prophecy yet to happen is actually history that has already occurred, and we are the new wave of history that's taking place since that
right.
point.
And many people have noticed that over the years, it's almost like the elites and the bankers and everybody's all working off a script. And in essence, they really are. They're working off a script of stuff that already happened.
Well, what is, talking about the kind of the elite, what is the New World Order? You cover it in your book as well. What exactly are you referring to?
The New World Order is basically the 1% that rules the world. Used to be just so much of a crazy conspiracy theory, but over the last year with email releases and the deep state and all the little conspiracies and corruptions going on, people are now starting to realize that our world is ran by a very small group of people. And what's important about my book in relation to this is the religion that holds this small group of people together is this mystery religion, this knowledge, this dream vision. And it's the hidden religion that everybody's been wondering about. And they help encourage the misidentification of thinking that it's just Satan worship or the occult or paganism when it's not really any of those things. They use it for a distraction.
Are there objectives? Do you believe that they've changed over time from, you know, throughout history, from when they came to existence to what they want and desire and try to lead now?
No, I really don't. I think they're pretty open about wanting to achieve a new world order consisting of one government, one religion, one economy, one military, everything under one house, under one roof that they control. And a fascinating aspect of kind of seeing that now is we're seeing Islam starting to be pushed across the Western world. And this most likely is probably the one world religion that the elites want. That's the kind of the aspect that people have been kind of missing in this, and then pushing Islam because it's a ideal religious belief for a one world government where religion and government are one in the same.
All right. With all the work that you've put into this research and all the years that have passed since the original book came out to now, what has been one of the most startling facts that you've uncovered that has even left you astounded that this is not common knowledge, or this is not known worldwide by this point in our history?
I don't know. That's kind of a hard one. I've been actually astounded by how effective and how simple it has been for them to hide this in plain sight. I mean, the symbolism is all around everybody, and nobody recognizes it. They don't understand that the, you know, the all-seeing eye and the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill is related to a war buried deep in the dream vision. And I don't know. I guess I don't have a good answer for you.
All right. Are there still things that you're looking into as you're getting ready to re-release this book later on this year? Are there still elements that you think the threads you're pulling are starting to unravel and shine a light on a whole different subject you might not have even realized before?
Not so much outside of trying to get a better understanding of what exactly each animal in the story represents, which groups, and suspecting that they represent some of the other groups from mythology. It's been fascinating. It's very convoluted and very difficult to follow. But there's indications there that I might put into the new book is, we may even have an explanation within the biblical text of where the hairy man, better known as Bigfoot, might have come from. And that's kind of one of those little strange little doors that have opened of late.
Wow. Well, great. Keep us in mind as more of this knowledge is revealed to you. The forbidden knowledge of Enoch. RJ, thank you so much for being here with us. How can people keep up with you? Where is the best site to visit?
Right now would be to follow me on Facebook, just under RJ Von Bruning. I also have a blog at forbiddenknowledgeofenoch.blogspot.com.
And we'll put links up to both of those as well on the site so you can find it.
But I should warn people that the blog is getting ready to undergo a major change, so it might be offline for a little bit while it's being under construction. Those are the two best right
now.
Fair
enough. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us tonight. It's been fascinating. I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thanks. I enjoyed it and great.
Great. Well, thank you. We've got the Queen of Mystery and the Paranormal joining us tomorrow, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, back with us where she belongs. We'll be back with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio tomorrow, right here on Beyond the Darkness.